This is the warm days that drift away while the sun sets and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile.
Spitfire Bees, the lives of women of color in Montreal, we come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. Welcome to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. Tonight we discuss the proposed Charter of Quebec Values that has stirred lots of controversy this past month, with some calling the charter necessary to preserve Quebec identity and secularity, while others claim it's simply racist.
We will also remember the 50th anniversary of the September 15th, 1963 Birmingham bombing, where four little girls died and many others injured after the Ku Klux Klan planted dynamite in the church. Denise McNair, age 11, Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wellesley, and Addie Mae Collins, all 14 years old, were killed. 20 other people were injured. No one was arrested for the bombings for 14 years. We will play excerpts from a recent address given by Professor Angela Davis.
Finally, this evening's program is dedicated to the legendary and beloved American soul and funk star, Sharon Jones. As a vocal powerhouse and charismatic stage performer, Sharon Jones has led her band, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, to breakthrough success and critical acclaim in the recent mass revival of soul and funk music. By bringing the sound of soul and funk as it was at its height in the 1960s and 1970s, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings have rocked audiences from across North America to Europe with five album releases since 2002 and a new album, Bring the People What They Want, in the horizon for soon. In therapeutic musical accompaniment to tonight's feature stories, we will be playing a number of our favorite songs by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. From everyone here at Spitfire, we are sending through the radio waves our appreciation, love, and support to the humble, kind, great, sassy, soul conduit herself, Sharon Jones. To our audiences, we hope you enjoy this evening's tribute soundtrack.
All that and more coming up on another edition of Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
I was talking to a friend of mine. Said he don't want no wars no more. Children of America, it's up to you. Let Mr. Politician know how you feel. Let him know that you're not going to take no more. Stop paying taxes. Stop paying for corruption and injustice. It's up to you.
Welcome back, soul people. That was Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. What if we all stop paying taxes, from the album Soul Time, released in 2011. This is Spitfire on radio, Spitfire Radio on CKUT 94.3 FM.
The Center for Gender Advocacy invites you to Rutaya Parsons' Was My Daughter, an evening with Glenn Canning, the keynote event of our upcoming event series, Another Word for Gender, an intro to feminist organizing in action. Glenn Canning has been seeking justice for his daughter, Rutaya Parsons, in the wake of her sexual assault and suicide. Glenn will share his thoughts on the cultural and political forces that normalize and excuse sexual assault, the need for publicly funded counseling and consent education, as well as the role of men in challenging rape culture. Come out to this not-to-be-missed talk on Thursday, October 3rd at 6 p.m. at McGill University in the SSMU Ballroom, located at 3600 McTavish, 3rd floor. For more info, visit genderadvocacy.org, a CKUT co-presentation.
Pop Montreal and CKUT are bringing you 70s blues songstress Dorothy Moore on September 26th at Cabaret Mile End. The legend, who received a standing ovation at the Blues Music Awards this year, will be joined by openers Katie Moore and Kay Sun. For tickets and info, visit popmontreal.com. You don't want to miss this show.
Missing Justice presents the 8th Annual Sisters in Spirit March and Vigil for Missing and Murdered Native Women on Friday, October 4th, to commemorate the lives of Indigenous women and denounce the violence. De 18h à 21h commence dans le Square Cabot, au coin de l'avenue Atwater et rue Sainte-Catherine, leaving the park by 7 p.m. and taking to the streets. The march will feature the voices of many Indigenous leaders and organizers, and spoken word, drumming, and musical performances. On September 26th, Missing Justice and the Center for Gender Empowerment present a public talk with Norman Achnipinishkum on the residential school system and violence against Native women. Dans le hall building de l'Université Concordia, 1455 de Maisonneuve-Ouest, salle 414 à 19h. Come out to learn more and show your love in solidarity. A CKUT co-presentation.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 6:13 p.m. And now I will pass you on to the lovely Malek.
Thank you, Mercedes. Amnesty International says it violates Canadian and international law by infringing on freedom of expression and religion, and claims it will further stigmatize vulnerable women. Justin Trudeau claims it's a cynical wedge issue designed to shore up a Pure Land Québécois base and foment conflict with the federal government so as to promote Quebec separatism, while Thomas Mulcair refers to it simply as unacceptable. Meanwhile, Stephen Harper, not often on the right side of any issue, says if this thing becomes law, he'll take, quote, whatever action necessary to stop it. Within Quebec, the Liberal Party, the PQ's official opposition in Parliament, says if it goes through, they'll call an election over the issue. But what issue are we talking about exactly? What has got Canadians within and outside Quebec so up in arms? What we're talking about, of course, is the Quebec Charter of Values. A proposal first announced on May 22nd of this year, but whose details the Quebec government only released this past September 10th. These details are as follows. 1. That the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms would be amended to clearly state the religious neutrality of the state and the secular nature of public institutions, as well as to set up the conditions under which requests for accommodation can be granted. 2. Because it's not enough to state these facts in the Quebec Charter, the PQ government proposes to pass a law outlining the duty of religious neutrality for all peoples who work for the state. Note, this duty already exists where political views are concerned, but the PQ apparently feels the state staff ought to have no religious ties either. What's next? No wearing the colors of your favorite sports team on game day? 3. To ensure no person working for the state violates this legal duty of religious neutrality, the PQ proposes to limit the wearing of so-called conspicuous religious symbols for state personnel, again, simply to reflect the neutrality of the state. Lest we misunderstand, when referencing these personnel, this is who we're talking about. The staff of all provincial ministers and agencies, as well as judges appointed by Quebec, prosecutors and attorneys, the police and those working as correctional officers, as well as those working in early childhood centers and subsidized private daycare, as well as anyone working under the jurisdiction of primary and secondary school boards, and all staff of cégeps and universities, as well as the staff of the public health and social services networks, and finally, any municipal worker. So no, we're not talking about the few bureaucrats who work behind the counter when you want to renew your driver's license or RAMQ card. If you're a little girl growing up in Quebec who dreams of being a lawyer or, God forbid, a judge, who dreams of being a doctor or a teacher or a cop or, hell, even a garbage lady, well, then you better not be a little Muslim girl. Or, if you unfortunately are, then we're going to have to insist you trample upon your values and your conscience and your culture and substitute them for ours. In other words, take that damn thing off your head and let people see your hair. Beautiful feminist message, no? 4. As if prohibiting Muslim women from working for the state wasn't enough, the PQ would like to prohibit them from receiving any state services if they dare to go the extra mile and wear a niqab, similar to the Muslim hijab, only here covering the face as well as the hair. That's right. We here in Quebec value equality between men and women, and to that end, we've decided that women choosing to or pushed to wear this traditional covering ought not be allowed to attend school, visit an emergency room, send their children to daycare, or utilize the protection offered to all citizens under the legal system and the courts. 5. To complete this Orwellian wet dream, the PQ would like to have all state departments and agencies adopt a policy of implementation to ensure religious neutrality and request for religious accommodation. And yes, mechanisms for accountability will be instituted. Big Brother never stops watching in Quebec. By far, the most controversial element of this charter has been point 3, the limiting of supposedly ostentatious religious symbols. Much has been made of which symbols are deemed ostentatious and which are not. For example, wearing a large cross pendant is unacceptable, but a small cross is just fine. Similarly, in the mind of the PQ anyway, a crescent moon and star ring is okay, but the hijab is too outlandish. If anything, these guidelines reflect the PQ's profound ignorance of the Muslim faith. Had Ms. Marois or anyone drafting this outlandish proposal bothered to talk to a Muslim woman, they would quickly learn that to the women who choose to wear it, the hijab is not simply an ornament of extremism that it's so often imagined to be, but in reality, a deeply felt duty of faith reflecting one's love of and obedience to a God who requires modesty. Perhaps the PQ imagines that they can bully Muslim women into simply removing their veils, but it's hardly that simple. Given the choice between their God and their career aspirations, Quebec will no doubt be surprised how many women will opt out of the latter in favor of the former. The result? Muslim women will be further isolated and locked out of a community that claims it's acting in their best interest. But perhaps where the PQ is concerned, this seeming disappearance of Muslim women from public life really isn't such a tragedy. Consider for a moment the motivation behind this charter. In a leaflet entitled, "Because We Believe in Our Values," sent out via mass mailing by the Quebec government last week, the following statement is made. What we propose today with the statement of these values is to build a strong Quebec identity, whether it's here or elsewhere. Ah, yes, a strong Quebec identity. That's what this is really about, isn't it? Identity. who fits in and who doesn't. The message is clear. The Quebec identity is not a tapestry, okay? It's not a quilt made up of many patches by which each new arrival weaves in its own unique and beautiful threads into a multicultural patchwork built on plurality and openness, built on neutrality. No, the Quebec identity is a singular thing, an unchanging thing. Quebec, after all, is a nation, one constantly under threat and therefore constantly vigilant about maintaining uniformity. Let's be honest. No one's really concerned that somehow Quebec ceased to be run by a secular state. That's why we've never heard anyone in government challenge the Duplessis crucifix in the National Assembly or the massive cross lit nightly on Mont Royal. No, what we're concerned about is something far more sinister. An alien invasion of backwards Muslims, never mind that the turban originates in the Sikh faith, come to remake Quebec in the image of Afghanistan. Folks, this is racism, pure and simple. And it has no place in a Quebec desperately concerned about religious neutrality. True neutrality would be for the state to welcome all people, regardless of their ethnicity or race or religion or the wardrobe choices that are part and parcel of these things.
Well, thank you, Molek. Like, I don't know if you can sum that up better than that, but if anyone's out there who can, I dare you to try. So, ladies, we are going to have our own discussion about this Charter of Values and put our voices out there. So let's talk about the pressing issue of true equality. What does that actually mean, and is it possible with this charter?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely not. I actually have a little bit of a different take because I'm a militant atheist. So I have rejected my brutal Catholic upbringing, and I'm pretty much live my life as an atheist and happy about that. At the same time, I'm really struck with how xenophobic attempts to use religion as a proxy to do exactly what Molek was saying, which is basically enforce racism, impose racist policies on certain groups of people based on the visibility of their religiosity. But I would argue that the visibility of the religiosity is more because that religiosity is seen as an other in the West. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, Christianity is really visible, as Molek very cleverly pointed out. There's a giant cross in the biggest city in Quebec on top of the mountain that pretty much is a signifier for you are in the center of Montreal. You are looking at Mount Royal. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a state to be on the one hand claiming some sort of commitment to religious neutrality under the guise of equality, women's rights, but then having things like a giant crucifix. I mean, even if people are Christian, what in Christianity symbolizes like equality for women? I mean, there's sexism in that religion. So it's just, it seems like the government wants to have a conversation that they can't have openly. So they're using this mechanism, which is not even really original, right? I mean, France has been doing this, been trying this for years. And other states where there's like this fear of immigration passes similar measures to try and, you know, just respond, I guess, to the fear of losing, I guess, the whiteness of a particular population. I mean, I see similarities between this and the U.S. Republicans trying to make English the official language of the states, you know, because of just the fear of all these Mexicans coming in with their Spanish language and Mexican culture.
We have to keep it the same.
But it's also, who is the we, right? I mean, who is the we? We in this room, many of us are citizens and all of us are residents. Right. I mean, we are paying taxes. We are contributing to society. Right. We are productive citizens. Like, I hate the word citizen, but I mean, I just really hate the we in this. Like, who is the we? I mean, people are living here or breathing the air, but then they're constantly being told that they're not we. But then at the same time, there's like the celebration of this national identity. But it's like, who's in the national? Is it a club? I mean, do you have to be in Quebec City to be in the club? I don't know, because it's so out of whack with how me, as someone who lives in Montreal, lives her life.
And that is, I think, a very important question that everyone needs to ask themselves. And then it brings us to this question of intersectionality in terms of race, gender, and white privilege. Like you said, who is the we? what is a Quebecois and who can identify as a Quebecois if we all live here.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we talk about this every month.
I know. Well,
we talked about this last month for like
a just think of this. It's too. A deja vu moment where
under
it's kind
threat,
of like
apparently every single month.
Yeah. Well, just think of like of this. It's been a leading up to, except up to this point, except now it's just been put in one just, I don't know, place, legislation, moment. But yeah. Everything that's happened the last couple of months, especially mm-hmm. with the whole niqab issue, not niqab, but the hijab issue, the turban issue, the whether or not courses, religious courses should be offered in public schools. Like, I mean, that's nothing new. That's nothing that hasn't been spoken about, except now it's coming up and now it's just a full force movement.
I think it's also an insult to Quebecois people who mm-hmm. who do care and celebrate their culture mm-hmm. who are having it hijacked by a bunch of xenophobic people who have this irrational fear that the French language is somehow evaporating and that the French heritage is eviscerating. I mean, you know, if you can set aside for a second the fact that the French presence in Canada historically is one of is a colonial presence and has reaped a lot of pain on a lot of other cultures and communities. Yeah. But I mean, okay, to the extent that I support cultural autonomy, I mean, I could say, okay, people really care about the French language. There's a very specific history that a group of people who live in Canada and other parts of North America, they speak French. Okay, fine. So why are you allowing people who are extremely xenophobic mm-hmm. and hateful to do things in the name of the culture? Like, right. I just wish I was hearing more Quebecois voices in unison against this. And I know that there are a lot of people who are very much against it. I mean, I would say that the people who are for it are not the majority of Quebecois right. francophones, people that I know who identify as Quebecois.
Right.
But I just wish that there was more consensus on that, because I think this is a really bad way to protect a culture. It's just a bad strategy.
Right.
It's so alienating.
Well, and it's just crazy because apparently what this charter shows is that, you know what, the French language isn't enough anymore. You came here, you learned French, you sent your children to school in French, but you know what? That's not good enough.
But I mean, Nydia was talking about this last month, right? I mean, it's not about speaking French. I mean, she said her name is Nydia Dauphin.
Right.
You know, like French is her first language. Yeah. She's from Montreal, but she's an outsider.
Exactly.
Because there's something about her that's not French, even though... I mean, what else could she do?
Yeah.
Aside from change who she, like, not be herself.
That's exactly it. Like, they basically, I think what they're saying is that I think even if, let's say, Muslim women en masse, you know, rejected the hijab in Quebec, which is not going to happen. But let's just say in a PQ wet dream that happened. I still don't think it'd be good enough, frankly.
Exactly.
I mean, Nydia spoke up. She doesn't wear a hijab, you know. And it's basically what it's saying is like, look, this is our place for us, where that's defined as this ethnically Quebecois identity. And basically, you don't fit and you never will. So you know what? Get out, because we want this for ourselves anyway.
Do you think it's drawing parallels on Trudeau's white paper policy with the Native Americans in 1969?
Say more.
Well, in terms of, like, policy, it was basically, like, an assimilation ploy, just to sum it up in, like, two words or less, whereas basically they couldn't have their Aboriginal identity or Native American identity. They had to identify as either Canadian or not reap the benefits of being a citizen. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, the way I see it, it's a little bit the same way, where it's like, as you were saying before, it's either come in and fit in or just don't come here and don't belong and just be on the periphery and just watch.
It's such a false promise, though. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, how can you ask people who are visibly non-white to just come here and be like us? I mean, again, like, what are they supposed to do? Paint their skin?
Yeah.
I mean, change their name?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's just, it's such a circular false promise.
Well, also, it's a power dynamic, too.
Right, yeah.
Because you are the majority. You are, let's say, the white majority, but what can you do? So why do you think, coming back to the PQ... and French language and all that good stuff. Why are there so few people of color who are, you know, francophone, who can technically kind of maneuver themselves within all of this? Why do you think they aren't feeling comfortable enough to come out and say anything or identify with the PQ if they could? Because, I mean, they do fit in with kind of the standard of being francophone, being able to, let's say, quote unquote identify with Quebec because they are here.
Right.
Yet you don't hear much from them being like, well, I agree with the PQ and the Charter of Values because I can, let's say, deal with it, if you want to call it that.
Or just so few people of color who are members of the PQ.
Well, yeah, that's where we should start.
And, you know, the one, what the clearest case of someone who was, who dared to make some pretty mild statements against the Charter, well, they were kicked out.
No, that was the Bloc Party.
The federal Bloc Québécois.
Yeah, yeah, but I would say that the Bloc.
And the yeah, PQ they represent have, the right. PQ interests federally. Right. Yeah, very modest, just, I don't, you know, just suis pas d'accord avec la Charte Québécoise. Mm-hmm. Very simple.
Right.
But no, not allowed. I really think, though, that this is kind of, to me, this symbolizes the last stand of the PQ politically. I mean, just to play, just to talk about politics for a second.
Sure.
It seems like they couldn't, after all of the animosity and anger at Charte for all the corruption, the student tuition policies. Mm. There was clear space in provincial politics mm-hmm. for the PQ to really sweep in and take a majority and impose their mandate even more forcefully.
Right.
And they couldn't really pull off anything more than a modest minority government, which might fall after this thing is passed if they don't drop it.
Right.
So I really feel it seems like they know it's over. They know they're losing popularity. They know that even younger Quebecois people don't necessarily respond to these tactics because they're just really off-putting. I mean, even for people who don't have consciousness, you know, who don't have any concern for religious diversity and pluralism, it just doesn't make sense in a contemporary urban environment.
Right.
So to me, it's like a sign that we know it's over and we're really nervous and we have a lot of anxiety about that. So let's double down on the demographics are with us.
Right.
And I mean, we'll go to war with that and we'll see how we, you know, win on the other side.
But if this is a tactic for them, since their backs are up against the wall, then what's next?
I don't know.
This is,
but they keep ratcheting it up, right? Like, they're so worried about French.
Right.
But, I mean, where is French going? I mean, yeah, Montreal is becoming, I guess, more of a 50-50 city. But, I mean, the rest of Quebec definitely is not.
Yeah.
I mean, they have their own judicial system. They collect their own taxes.
Right.
They get the most federal taxes transferred to them than any other province. Mm-hmm. I mean, beyond, I guess, a sovereign nation state that's recognized by the United Nations and the neighboring North American nation states, what can you gain? What is there to be gained? And also, what is the vision for an independent Quebec? Are you going to have your own currency? I just feel like it's like so much pushing these red buttons on cultural issues, but then there's no actual vision for how that's going to benefit people who live in the province. And in the meantime, there is, I feel, a vibrant French-speaking culture that's autonomous, that's awesome. I mean, part of why I love Montreal is because you hear French spoken on the street. Like, it and French culture is very present here in ways that it's not in other North American cities, right? Mm-hmm. That's a very unique feature of Montreal as being part of the Francophonie, you know, globally even. So, I mean, there's so many things to celebrate, but then it's like, you would, if you just listen to what Pauline Marois has to say, it's like, you know, Anglophones are invading and looting things.
Well, that's what it is. They feel like it's just blending into the image of what is Montreal, what is Quebec, and it's not distinct anymore. And I think that's where they're coming from with this.
In my final year of university, more years ago than I'd like to state at this point, I took this class called Is Domestic Israeli Politics. And I ended up writing this paper sort of about domestic politics within Israel and sort of how Israel defines itself as an ethnic and democratic state. But there's all these arguments of, well, can you be a nation that's truly ethnically based and then also be democratic? Because if you're constantly favoring a particular ethnicity, then how is that truly democratic? And, of course, Israel justifies this policy by saying, well, we're under threat, you know, and if we don't define ourselves as ethnically based, we're going to disappear.
And the mandate for the state of Israel is that it is a Jewish homeland. I mean, that's the main justification for the existence of that state.
Right.
So.
And I see so many parallels between those sort of arguments that happen within Israel and the arguments that we're seeing within Quebec, this idea of, well, we're a nation that's ethnically defined. but yet also somehow democratic. And so obviously French is a very popular location on which to play out that debate, but now we're seeing it's moving out of the realm of purely linguistically based, and now it's moving into ethnicity, into religion. And it's just really scary to me because, as Mercedes was saying, you know, where's it going to go next? Okay, so we've got the language bit. We've got the religion bit. What are we after next? I hate to use this example, and it is often really too overwrought, but, I mean, gosh, is this 1930s Germany? You know, that, I mean, we're moving further and further into this purification of Quebec, and it's just really scary, frankly, as an Arab woman.
Fair enough, fair enough. Well, you've heard from Spitfire, and hopefully this is food for thought as you go through the rest of your evening and think about what's going on in the politics of Quebec and where you live.
Thank you.
Because we need that money to pay the bills, to pay the rent, huh? Banks falling, president scratching his head, the economy is down, Wall Street about to lose him, I'm up and down, gas prices up and down, nobody knows what to do. You know what we need, though?
Money by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings from their fourth studio album, I Learned It the Hard Way. The album debuted number 15 on the U.S. Billboard 200, selling 23,000 copies in the first week. Whoa. You are listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on 90.3 FM. Take it, Alyssa.
Okay, it's just before 6:40, Wednesday, September 25th. We're now about to hear excerpts from an address by renowned actor, activist, and scholar Angela Davis, professor emeritus at the University of California, Santa Cruz, renowned civil rights, freedom rights activist, black woman. She spoke on Sunday, September 15th at an event organized by the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project at Northeastern University School of Law. She remembers the Birmingham bombings that killed four little girls on September 15th, 1963.
In remembering and paying tribute to this tragic event, let us not pretend that we are simultaneously celebrating the end of racist violence and the triumph of democracy. Let us also not labor under the illusion that this church bombing was an anomaly. We know that Robert Chambliss, who was eventually convicted of carrying out the bombing, along with three others, we know that he had been responsible for bombing black homes and churches over so many years. As a matter of fact, during the 8 years prior to the church bombing, there had been 21 bombings in Birmingham. This man's nickname was Dynamite Bob. He was known in white communities. You know, talking about terrorism, I want to emphasize the importance of understanding how much terrorism, racist terrorism, has shaped the history of this country. And there are lessons we need to learn from that. But I've often pointed out that some of my very earliest childhood memories are the sounds of dynamite exploding. Homes across the street from where I grew up were bombed when they were purchased by black people who were moving into a neighborhood that had been zoned for whites. So many bombings took place in the neighborhood where I grew up, and we now know that Chambliss was probably responsible, that the neighborhood came to be called Dynamite Hill. And of course, as you know, the city of Birmingham was known as Bombingham. In fact, on September 4th, 1963, less than 2 weeks before the 16th Street church bombing, the home of the leading civil rights attorney in Birmingham, Arthur Shores, was bombed. And that house was right down the street from our house. You've also heard that from Bukhari Maiwetu and from Margaret that on the day of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, two other black youth were killed, Johnny Robinson and Virgil Ware. Bombings continued to plague black communities in Birmingham after September 15th, and everyone, including the FBI, knew who was behind them. But Robert Dynamite Bob Chambliss was simply charged with the possession of dynamite, and J. Edgar Hoover refused to reveal the evidence that the FBI had gathered against the perpetrators so that there was no trial during that period. Now, I'm not arguing that justice would have necessarily prevailed had Robert Chambliss and the others, Thomas Blanton and Bobby Cherry, Herman Cash, had they been immediately tried and convicted. Although since that was the only way we had to deal with such transgressions, they should have been tried and convicted. But true justice is about transformation. Justice is about changing the relations that link us together. And as you've heard, the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project attempts to forge justice in a much deeper sense than is possible within the existing criminal justice system. A broader way of thinking about justice in the case of the Birmingham bombing would require, first of all, a fuller understanding of the event and its historical context, and would require us to ask questions about the way our lives today bear the historical imprint of that era. What I fear is that many of the 50th anniversary observances, and there are many, as Margaret pointed out, many that have taken place, many to come, that many of them urge us to close the book on the racist violence of the civil rights era, so that we can embalm that violence and transform it into something to be gazed at through the conventional lens of the museum. Maybe there's something to be learned from the way that the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute frames that bombing. As opposed to a regular museum exhibit, and if any of you have ever visited the Civil Rights Institute, you know that it is an absolutely incredible museum with amazing exhibits. But for the church bombing, there's simply a window. There is a window through which one can see the church, meditate on its history, and see it as it changes and transforms, remembering that this was the site of one of the most vicious terror attacks this country has witnessed. If you've ever visited Birmingham and the museum, you will also know that across 6th Avenue from the museum and kitty corner from the church is the Kelly Ingram Park, where demonstrations that were organized in the 16th Street Baptist Church were staged. It was the home base for the Children's Crusade. And how many of us remember that it was young children, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, some as young as 9 or 10, who faced police dogs and faced high power water hoses and went to jail for our sake. And so there is deep symbolism in the fact that these four young girls' lives were consumed by that bombing. It was children who were urging us to imagine a future that would be a future of equality and justice. It's important that we resist the temptation of abstraction. How easy it is to think about four innocent young black girls whose lives were violently taken away by white supremacists. And I'm not suggesting that this did not happen. Of course it did. What I'm saying is that it was a lot more complicated. And if we don't attempt to understand the complexity of this historical event, then we will certainly not be capable of comprehending that violence, that racist violence, and its connections with sexist violence, or homophobic and xenophobic violence, which continues to erupt in our lives today. Resisting the temptation of historical abstraction requires us to realize that this was not an extraordinary event that erupted one Sunday morning 50 years ago in an otherwise peaceful city. As I pointed out, violence was very much the norm. When I was growing up, Eugene Bull Connor, was the commissioner of public safety. And of course, his notoriety is linked to the way in which he used those high power water hoses and dogs against the children, and because of the KKK violence against the Freedom Riders in Birmingham, in which the police, whom Bull Connor controlled, did not intervene. But I remember growing up hearing, that when black people moved into previously white neighborhoods, Bull Connor would announce that there would be bloodshed, and then indeed there would be a bombing, or a house would be burned. As much talk as there has been about terrorism over the last decade, I have not heard one official acknowledgement of the terrorism that prevailed in places like Birmingham. Terrorism is a part of our history. It is not something that is alien. And by the way, no one ever suggested that we plant dynamite in white communities as a response to that terrorism. So I guess I would say, why do we need to respond with devastating violence in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria? It is also not widely known that black people arm themselves. This is the story that has been excised from the official record of the freedom movement. And interestingly, Condoleezza Rice has described her minister father, this is recently in an interview with Al Sharpton, she described her minister father as being a leader of an armed patrol of black men in her neighborhood. And as she pointed out, no one was ever shot. Guns may have been fired to scare the Ku Klux Klan away. They may have been, she says, they may have been fired in the air, but no one was ever shot. No one was ever hurt. And I wonder why she didn't learn this lesson about ways to respond to terrorism, you know, which she could have used during her tenure as Secretary of State. But my father was also a member of an armed patrol in our neighborhood. Black people had guns, but only because we had no other choice. Black people had to arm themselves after the 1877 Hayes-Tilden Compromise, in which the Republican Rutherford Hayes was handed the presidency under the condition, remember the Republicans were supposed to be the good guys in those days, under the condition that he withdraw all federal troops from the South. And so black people were effectively informed that they were on their own from then on, from 1877 on. This is the period that witnessed the emergence of official structures of white supremacy that did not begin to come down until the resistance of the mid-20th century freedom movement. Just as sediments of slavery are still with us, most dramatically represented by the country's incarceration practices and by the racism of the death penalty, the vestiges of an era where racist violence was the norm and was condoned by officials from local governments to Washington are still haunting us. We know the names of young black and brown people who have been killed by the police or by vigilantes. We know the names of Trayvon Martin in Florida, of Hydea Pendleton in Chicago, who was killed shortly after having participated in the second Obama inauguration. And then, of course, here in Oakland, we know the name of Oscar Grant. Oscar Grant. And I can say that no matter how long an individual perpetrator is sent to prison, in any of these cases and in the others, no one can say that justice has been done. Because we know that the roots of racist violence, the roots of the violence that claim their lives, are so tightly woven into our country's social fabric that an eye for an eye will not do it. An eye for an eye will not do it.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. I tell you, this land.
for you and me.
Listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio only on 90.3 FM CKUT. That was full funk soul legend Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings' rendition of This Land Is Your Land. Just some music history for you. This Land Is Your Land is one of the United States' most famous folk songs, written and composed by Woody Guthrie in critical response to Irving Berlin's anthem God Bless America. The rendition we just heard includes the critiques of private property and poverty from Woody Guthrie's original 1940 lyrics, with additional nuance and the signature Sharon Jones tell it like it is, dose of the real, characteristically soul lyric improvisation. And for those of you who just tuned in, we've been featuring the music of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings throughout our show in tribute to the great lady. Currently, Sharon Jones is in NY State recovering from a serious cancer treatment. We are all sending her love and support from Spitfire Women of Color Radio.
Yeah.
She writes on her Facebook page, "Thankfully, I'm feeling stronger and more focused on getting back out on the stage every day."
Woo! Go so, Sharon!
Go Sharon! We love you.
So thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Turn me up. Pass every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca. Check out our blog, spitfire.blogspot.com. And also follow us on Twitter at Spitfire Radio. Don't forget the exclamation mark.
Make your money, y'all.
Peace!
Just do what you got to do.
nothing gain, nothing tried. Very few even try. Most just wanna get high from the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave, and I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me, support me or snake me. Either way, I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream. It's